There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Welcome back to The Grill. It is live from Barasta. It is myself, Chris McCarty, Carl Van Roosevelt, Mark Archer. We're with you through until 6 o'clock. If you are just joining us, of course, we've been on live on the airwave since 3 p.m. We've been looking back on the Golden State Warriors, a third NBA title in 4 years, for they are the creme de la creme of the world of basketball, no doubt about it. We've also been reminiscing on the Washington Capitals winning their first ever Lord Stanley Cup as well, a 4-1 success over the Las Vegas Golden Knights. We've also been keeping an eye on the International Rugby Union matches that are ongoing throughout the day. We saw a little earlier the All Blacks dismantle the French 52 points to 11. The full-time whistle has just blown down in Brisbane, the Suncor Stadium. It is Australia against Ireland, and if you're Irish, it's not a good result.
Not a good result for you, and a little bit unlucky as well, Chris. What I can tell you is that Australia have won the first test match, 18 points to 9. The Aussies have won that one, and a big congratulations to them. Just a couple of results from earlier this morning. You mentioned Japan playing Italy, the Japanese beating the Italians 34 points to 17, and the All Blacks teaching the French a rugby lesson, 52 points to 11. 7 unanswered tries by the All Blacks in that second half, and as I say, what a fantastic display. We've just had Australia seeing off Ireland, as I said, 18 points to 9. And then, of course, a little bit later on this evening at 7 o'clock, South Africa take on England, and then at 20-12, Argentina take on Wales.
What about the cricket? Not much in the way of international cricket to tell you about this afternoon, but the Aussies are over in the UK. They are building up for an ODI series against the English?
Yeah, they're taking on an ODI series. The first match is on Wednesday. It's a day-night match in London. They're playing Middlesex today at Lord's. I can tell you Australia are batting first. They won the toss and elected to bat first, making a decent fist of it at the moment. 33 overs of their 50 is completed. They have 167 for 3. Travis Head is 73 not out, and Aaron Finch is 12 not out. So Australia, 167 for 3. They take on England during the week, Wednesday in London, the first of, I think it's 3 ODIs in that series. Of course, both teams now trying to get their squads together 12 months out from that Cricket World Cup, which is going to be held in the UK. So it's valuable preparation time for the Aussies. And, of course, England have been, now the top team in ODI cricket, so they'll be looking to secure that position there. There is one test ongoing. It hasn't started today yet. It's in Port of Spain in the Caribbean. The West Indies taking on Sri Lanka in the first test match there. Day three gets underway in an hour or so's time. Day two stumps. The West Indies are firmly in control of this match. They scored 414 for 8 declared in their first innings, dismissed Sri Lanka yesterday for 185, and the West Indies at stumps 131 for 4. So they have a lead of 360 runs in that match with 6 second innings wickets remaining. West Indies firmly in control of the first test match against Sri Lanka.
Now then, I did say at the top of the show that the FIFA World Cup, I am excited. Are you boys excited? I know football's not your numero uno sports for either of you. Rugby is yours, Mark, right? Rugby union.
Rugby and cricket.
Rugby and cricket. For you, Carl, it's rugby.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm excited about the World Cup, and I think what's even more exciting this season is because we've got a representative team from the GCC. We can put it as the Saudi Arabian Eagles, and it's fantastic to see them in the tournament. And I think that I'm expecting a lot from them. I think that the opening games are going to be good. I do believe that they've got a bit of an outside chance. To get through to the next round.
Yeah, not to win.
To win. I mean, they haven't had the best of starts, but I'll, as I said, that will be my local team. That will be the team I will be supporting. But not much shouting about the World Cup, even though we've got only a couple of days left. To me, it's been very, very quiet this year. Not too many people really talking about it, not too many adverts on TV, etc., etc. But I think it's going to be a fantastic tournament, Chris. So I think, you know, if you just look at the team lineups, which I'm sure we'll discuss a little bit more in depth, I think it's going to be a very, very tightly contested affair.
I think that's why I'm so excited about this. I mean, we all say we've all got our personal favourite FIFA World Cups, and I do tend to subscribe to the view that everyone's favourite World Cup always tends to be their first one that they can remember. So for me, 1998 was the big one over in France. Zinedine Zidane scoring those two goals in the final, the French beating the Brazilians 3-0 at the Stade de France. That one for me stands out. But for some reason, this time around, I'm excited because I'll look at it, and similar to what you've said there, Carl, you look at Spain, you can make a good case, but you can also pick faults. You can look at Germany, make a good case, you can pick faults. You can do the same for Brazil. Maybe less faults on their side, but you can certainly pick why they are one of the favourites. Argentina, the last chance saloon for Lionel Messi. Cristiano Ronaldo in Portugal. We didn't expect them to win the European Championships, yet they did. Could they be a dark horse? We're talking Belgium, England. with a lot of expectation, or at least there has been an awful lot of expectation. I actually don't think, I for once, am of the belief that the English media and the English fans are keeping things under a lid. Now, whether that will be the case if they were to win their opening game 5-0 remains to be seen, but it's simmering up nicely, and I can't recall, and I could be wrong in all of this, but I can't recall, certainly since 1998, the last time I've been this excited about a World Cup.
I'm laughing to myself because 1998, you know which World Cup
yes.
I first remember?
I'll give you a guess. 1974.
No, I'm not that old. 1978 is my first sort of...
Close enough.
My first sporting memories, my first... Way a long way away, the other part of the world, New Zealand, obviously we don't get... Football's not our primary sport, but 1978 in Argentina, I think when Argentina won...
They did.
That was my first sort of sporting memory above anything else that I remember, the hype around the World Cup. And that
shows how old you are as well, actually.
Shows how global the game is. But then I also remember 1982 in Spain because we qualified, New Zealand qualified for the first time. Went on and played your Scotland, actually.
Yeah, we did.
Lost 5-2. We got two goals in that game. We're claiming that.
We'll claim that victory as
and
well.
And we lost to Brazil and we lost to, I can't remember, Russia. But you're right. You do remember World Cups. And so for me, 78 and particularly 82 which are the first ones I really sort of have some feeling for.
Obviously, yeah. You've had a World Cup down at your neck of the woods.
Yeah, and obviously that one was very, very special for us, 2010 World Cup. And, you know, to see South Africa play within that World Cup was fantastic. And that opening game against Mexico, I believe it was.
1-1.
No, Chabalala.
Chabalala, was it 1-0?
No, it was 1-1. You're absolutely right. But, of course, he's scoring the opening goal of the World Cup. But to me, another one that I really, really enjoyed was the 94 World Cup. First time in the US. Well, of course, it was a time of Roberto Baggio, you know, with Italy.
Romario.
All these type of players. And, of course, Ireland had a fantastic World Cup in 94.
I'm just going to put it, I said this during the week with Danny. I remember 94 very fondly. I was playing cricket in Ireland for the season. And we watched the games from a pub called The Goat in Goatstown. And I remember when Ireland...
You remember it?
Oh, not very well. But I remember Ireland, they beat Italy. Ray Houghton, who put the goal in the Italian net. Ray Houghton did. The song goes, and just the scenes of jubilation when they won that match. And I think they got beaten in the quarterfinals in the end. But wonderful being in a country like a city like Dublin, country like Ireland, when the Republic are going so well in the World Cup, everyone's spirits are massive. The other time, whilst it wasn't a World Cup, being in the UK, being in London in Euro 96, when England had some momentum behind them. It's a wonderful time when your team's going well.
Absolutely it is, and I guess the other reason that I remember 1998 so well, it's the last time that Scotland featured in a World Cup final. They actually were the opening match at the Stade de France against Brazil. It was Brazil 2, Scotland 1 on that occasion. Fond memories indeed. Let us know your memories on 4001 of the FIFA World Cup. I do believe it is bigger than the Olympics. I truly do, because football is the global game, and I can't wait for this. Fingers crossed it all passes without incident. I know there's an awful lot of people worried that Russia will host a successful World Cup. There will be no trouble. I think it's inevitable. There will be one or two skirmishes. I don't think we can get away from that. When all the people that will be gathering in Russia, let us just hope, though, that it does pass without major incident. And in terms of teams that you're looking forward to watching, you've said Saudi Arabia there for obvious reasons. They're flying the flag for the Arab nation, alongside the likes of Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco as well. Teams that you think are your favourite to win it. I'll start with you, Mark Archer.
Favourite to win it? I think that...
Don't say England.
No, I was speaking, I think, off air during the week, and I think England could go really well, but I also can see them getting knocked out at group stage. I can see them getting knocked out at group stage.
I think England will do well.
If they don't get a result in their first match or first
Tunisia,
two matches,
Tunisia,
I don't want them going to Belgium, having to beat Belgium in that third game to qualify, because I think that all then counters against them. I like Belgium. I like the talent. I just don't think they've maybe got... There may be a player, a leader or two short. It depends on, is Vincent Kompany going?
He is going. He's injured. No surprise there. And Roberto Martinez, the Belgian boss, is giving Vincent Kompany all the time required to see if he can recover from yet another injury.
I would love Belgium to do well, because if they do have good success, it means that they've probably played some great football. Kevin De Bruyne, Eden Hazard, they've got some super talent there. Romelu Lukaku up front, even Marion Fellaini. But they've got talent throughout that squad. If they progress, it means that they played well.
Yep.
And that would be wonderful for football. But I just don't think they've got the experience of doing well in big game tournaments. Look, in Europe, it's a World Cup in Europe. I'm going to go for a European team. For me, France is going to be there or thereabouts, or Germany. I can't see past those two teams. Ooh. One of the two teams getting to the final.
Wow, France, Germany for you, Carl. A lot of people make the assumption that Brazil don't do well in European World Cups. I do have to point out they did win it in 1958 in Sweden.
Yeah, 1958.
True, I get.
I wasn't born then either, Chris.
I do get the fact that the point that
70,
that's a long,
it was 70 years ago.
A long time ago was 1958. But at the same time, it does, it kind of, that is something I'm sure TT, the Brazilian national team boss, will be pointing out to his players. Don't let the hype that we don't do well in Europe get on top of you. Don't let the pressure mount, because history shows that we are capable of winning a World Cup. Brazil for you, Carl, or Argentina, Lionel Messi, what about his chances?
To me, everybody's not been saying anything about Argentina, which to me is always a dangerous thing. I mean, it's his last swan song. If he doesn't do it now, he will not win a World Cup. But there's two teams I'm going for, and the one I fancy the most is Belgium, because I think they've got a fantastic lineup from goalkeeper to striker. De Bruyne, if he continues the form that he's been showing in the Premier League, and Lukaku, you know, works on his work rate, I definitely think they can be a striker. And then to me, my outsiders, I would say, is Portugal, because Portugal went about winning the European Championship and nobody spoke anything about
it. Very true.
And I just kind of feel if one or two they need one or two things to go right for them. They need Ronaldo to play well. They need a couple of things to work for them. But I kind of feel that they could get to the latter stages of the World Cup and even maybe win it.
Interesting. The two dark horses then, Carl Van Roosevelt, is backing. I, for one, and I've said this, I'm really looking forward to this World Cup. I hope we see attacking football. I hope we see loads of thrilling action, a lot of goals. Having said all of that, I would take the most dulling World Cup ever seen known to man or woman if Lionel Messi could win it. I think just putting an exclamation mark against his career, Lionel Messi lighting up Russia on what has been dubbed his last chance saloon, I would pay an awful lot of money.
Does that settle the debate that he is the greatest player of the modern era then if he wins a World Cup?
Oh, I don't think there is a debate that he's the greatest player of the modern era.
No, of course there is.
There isn't for me.
For you, Chris, but I'm with Arch on this one. Come on.
If he wins the World Cup.
Of what Ronaldo has done, come on. It's so tight at the moment.
For you then, Chris, outside the big teams that we've talked about, the Germany, we know they'll be strong and solid and consistent. Outside of France, hugely talented team. Outside of Brazil, who do you see coming, who we don't talk about very often, in the world coming through and making an impact, making a statement?
Well, it's a bit easy. It's a bit of a cop-out, this, but Carl's called it, Belgium. I mean, Belgium on paper, and I know football matches are not won on paper, but you look from Thibaut Courtois. If Vincent Kompany is fit, it's a back three of Alderweireld, Kompany and Vertonghen. That's a Premier League four, two Spurs, a Man City and a Chelsea goalkeeper. Their five will be Thomas Meunier, the right wing back at PSG. Their left wing back will be Yannick Carrasco, who was at Atletico Madrid, who's now moved on to China, but a very good player. I question him defensively, but going forward, he offers them something different. The midfield three, I would imagine he'll go in with Kevin De Bruyne. It'll be Axel Witsel. And it'll be Moussa Dembele from Tottenham. Witsel over in China as well, but he's a good player. You know, he's probably too good for Chinese football. With all due respect to Chinese football, I think Axel Witsel could still be playing for a top club in Europe. And then it'll probably be Eden Hazard central, given the freedom to go make things happen with Romelu Lukaku. Now, you look at the options on the bench. They've got Marouane Fellaini. Say what you want about him, he's an effective footballer. They've got Dries Mertens, who's been hugely prolific over in Italy with Napoli for the past couple of seasons. They've got Mathieu Batshuayi, for goodness sake. The man, okay, his face didn't fit at Chelsea, but he's went to Germany and scored loads of goals for Borussia Dortmund. So they've got options on the bench as well. That's what I like about this Belgian side. They've got Adnan Januzaj as well, the young boy that failed at Manchester United, has gone away and rebuilt his career at Real Sociedad. So Belgium for me on paper. Now I'm with you, Carl, or I think it was maybe you, Arch. I question them, because you've tipped them to go all the way. It's with you, Arch. I question whether in a semi-final of a FIFA World Cup, the experience. Do they have the cool heads that they're able to eke out a performance if it's up against a Germany who have been over the course before, up against a Spain or a Brazil? That would be the one question mark, but there's no doubt they've got the players to do it. So Belgium, absolutely. I expect as well Croatia. I always look for Croatia to do well because, again, on paper, Ivan Rakitic, Luka Modric, they've got Kramaric as well,
Perisic.
Who's done well. Ivan Perisic. So Croatia, and they're in a group, it's a bit of a group of death. They're in there with Iceland, Nigeria and Argentina. Given the fact that Argentina are not good defensively, given the fact they fail to convince me that way, they convince me going forward because they've got the best player of his generation. I believe he's the greatest player that has ever lived on this planet, is Lionel Messi. So Argentina will always frighten you one way, but Croatia could be a team that could worry one or two. But they always flattered to deceive. Or certainly they did at the European Championships. They were the better team in their quarter-final against Portugal, and yet they came a cropper. So Croatia are capable of that. But I'm just excited, just talking about it now. We're 5 days away from the FIFA World Cup. I cannot wait. One thing I do hope, though, Ronaldo can win the World Cup, Messi can win the World Cup, Brazil can win it, Germany win it, France can win it, Spain can win it. I don't care, as long as England do not win the FIFA World Cup.
You've also said that you
fancy them to do well, England. I really do.
You fancy that we haven't got our predictions right, but I hear you've been doing something amazing with Farah the Falcon.
Tell us
what's going on.
We should reveal that, and if you have been listening to Dubai 103.8, you will know that Robbie and I, and not really Robbie and I, it's our producer Tom Smith, incredibly busy over the course of the past couple of months because, well, we've jumped on the bandwagon. I see. Paul the Octopus was the star back in 2006 predicting football matches. We thought about 3 months ago that we would try and be, well, a little original and come up with a Falcon to predict World Cup matches. I now see on social media that every Tom, Dick and Harry, we've got goldfish, we've got cockroaches, we've got pigeons, we've got parrots, we've got all sorts of animals predicting the World Cup. All I can say is Farah is a beautiful animal. Tom Smith has done a wonderful job. We are predicting all 64 matches in
Farah
this FIFA
is
world.
Predicting.
Farah is predicting. Yeah, you're right, it's Farah. Well, we will be predicting on air. But Farah, we've shot already the first 48 group matches, and she's picked a few doozies. And of course, for this to go truly viral, not only do we need the listeners' help, we hope as well that she's picking more rights than wrongs in all of this. But she's a beautiful animal, a two-year-old female Saker Falcon. We've had great fun doing it. It's been arduous, it's been long, it's been tough at times, but it's been rewarding, and we will be releasing our first video. It is Russia against Saudi Arabia. We're not taking ourselves too seriously. It is a little bit of fun. It's just to add a little colour to the carnival that is the FIFA World Cup. We will be releasing our first video, video number one, Tuesday at 11 a.m. That is Farah predicting the winner of Russia against Saudi Arabia. That is your opening match of the 2018 World Cup, Thursday evening from 7 p.m. We will continue to build up to the World Cup. We're also building up to the Women's French Open final at Simona Halep taking on Sloane Stephens. That one getting underway at 5. When we come back, we'll start the build-up towards that one. Stay tuned.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, in association with Barasti Superdome, the only place to view football this summer.
The Big Ten is open down here at Barasti, so if you are looking for somewhere to watch maybe the rugby or the French Open women's final, it gets underway in 35 minutes' time. Then comes the big one, South Africa against England in the Rugby Union down in Johannesburg. That one kicking off at 7, then do pop on down to Barasti. It is your home of all sport here in Dubai. Now then, I want to talk all things tennis in just a second. We are building up to that women's final kicking off. I say kicking off, it's not a football match, but starting at 5 p.m. It is Simona Halep taking on the American Sloane Stephens. Before the break, we were talking all things FIFA World Cup, and it is 5 days away. I want to get the thoughts now of Cristiano Ronaldo. He is undoubtedly, if not the best player of his generation, and he isn't, he's the second best, but he has been speaking ahead of Portugal's attempt to win the World Cup, and I think there's a bloody good argument then to have if he does go on and win the World Cup, whether he is the best of his generation and the best of all time. But this is Cristiano Ronaldo speaking before Portugal set off on their travels.
What I can guarantee is a great ambition of all of us players and the technical team. We know we're not the favourites. We have to be realistic. But in football, nothing is impossible. I think we must go game by game. The first match, then the group stage will be extremely difficult. But I think that with these players, we need to think big. And I'm confident that we will give our best.
The voice there of Cristiano Ronaldo. He is he's not confident. He's saying that we're not one of the favourites, but we will go there, we'll give it our all, and a bit like they did over in France in the European Championships. And if they stick to the ethos, the collective, and of course they've got a brilliant individual in Cristiano Ronaldo, and you've said it, Carl, you fancy them to be a little bit of a dark horse.
Yeah, I just kind of think that they're the team that... They are a pretty consistent team, and the thing I like about them is they don't really make too many. They're quite solid, especially from a defensive perspective. And then, of course, you've got Ronaldo there that, given any day, if he's on form, he can do the most amazing things with the football. So, you know, they do have that weapon, if you want to call it as such. And, yeah, I think, Chris, that, to be honest, it would be difficult for them to win it. But I think that there is a bit of an outside chance. And I think, you know, either him or Messi, I think it will be very, very well deserved.
Yeah, Jose Mourinho has tipped Spain to top that group. Of course, Spain and Portugal, the Iberian rivals, are in the same group alongside Morocco and Iran. It was interesting. He was working for a Russian television station, as he will be throughout the World Cup, old Jose Mourinho. And he was tipping Spain to top that group. And he said, you know, sorry, Portugal, my country, the country of my birth, but I will have good news for you towards the latter end of the tournament. So I just wonder if Jose, and he will make those predictions later on as the tournament starts. I just wonder if he is tipping Portugal, maybe not to go all the way, but maybe the semi-finals or who knows the final.
Yeah, maybe. I hope Jose is good at what he's doing, because I think if he doesn't pull up his socks at Manchester United, he might be working a little bit more frequently.
Indeed.
On TV.
A big season ahead for Jose Mourinho, of course, the club football. We will, I'm sure, be talking about that before you know it. The World Cup, though, will take all of our focus, certainly for the next 5 weeks or so. A couple of other stories, though, in the world of football, just very quickly to touch upon. The news yesterday, Harry Kane has signed a new six-year deal at Tottenham Hotspur, doubling his salary. Daniel Levy, the Spurs chairman, has essentially obliterated their wage structure in order to keep Harry Kane, their captain. No real surprise, that one. And it's a six-year deal, and as you said as well, Carl, six-year deal, it just says to any rivals who have maybe had a little fancy for Harry Kane, if you want him, you've got to pay top dollar.
They had to do it, Chris. They had to do it. He's a star player. He showed this season again what he's made of. And at the end of the day, I think Spurs have got away for a long, long time with probably paying him what he... not paying him what he deserves, I kind of feel, because that is how good a player he is. Yeah. But we were speaking a bit off air. I think Daniel Levy is a very, very smart businessman. He's locked in the coach Pochettino. He's now locked in his star player. And at the end of the day, come any club wanting to take them away, Spurs will make a lot of money on the deal, similar to what happened with Gareth Bale.
Exactly that, and there is some suggestion in the British press that Christian Eriksen and Dele Alli as well are in line for a huge, huge salary hike as well. So Spurs looking to put the building blocks in for the long term. Mauricio Pochettino, despite the interest or apparent or reported interest from Real Madrid, he has pledged his long-term future to Spurs, moving into a new stadium for next season as well. And there's a feel-good factor at that football club. Yes, okay, they've got to win a trophy, they've got to get it over that hump, but from a Spurs perspective and a Spurs fans perspective, Mark Archer, they are, I would imagine, a happy bunch. You've kept your captain, you've kept your goal scorer, you've kept your manager, you're going to keep the key figures. Now they need a big summer. Now they've got to go out and bring in the players that can take them from what was a top four finish to really genuinely challenge for the title.
It's interesting, the two North London clubs, Arsenal and Spurs, have had quite rigid pay structures and pay caps on their top players, and you'd like to be the agent of Dele Alli now or Christian Eriksen, because if Harry Kane's just got doubled the salary, you think the next guy's knocking on his door saying, hang on, we'd like a pay rise as well. Otherwise,
and that's what will be happening.
And that's the same as what's happened a little bit at Arsenal. We know they've been very rigid with their pay structures. As soon as they break the bank and they've signed
Mesut
Ozil on to double his salary to 300,000, yeah, the next guys coming in the door are going to, either the new transfers are going to want a lot more money. So interesting business practice, but that is the world we live in with Premier League football in particular. But no, good news if you're a Spurs fan. New stadium. You've kept your manager so far. I'm still not convinced he's not still in that conversation for Real Madrid. We know it's all been denied. We know he's signed the new contract a couple of weeks ago, but I'm still not convinced he's not still part of that conversation. That's why maybe they haven't announced anyone yet, but they must be getting close to making a new manager call. They want to get that wrapped up because signings have got to happen. And once the World Cup starts, it'll be such a busy time. Players don't want to be disrupted. So let's wait and see where it happens in the next week.
Arsene Wenger.
Well, is that the rumour, is it?
I've said it. I mean, he's up there as one of the favourites. He's out of a job, as we all know. He left Arsenal after 22 years. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I'm just throwing his name into the mix. Arsene Wenger.
And Chris, I think you've got all the right to do that. I'm not going to disagree with you. The only question that I've got against Arsene Wenger becoming the manager of Real Madrid, is he the guy to kind of rebuild the team? He doesn't really have age on his side, if I can put it as such. And I mean, I still see Wenger rather going to a national team than going to a club like Real Madrid, because we know the pressures that come with being the manager of Real Madrid.
Interesting. I think stranger things have happened in
given
football.
Given the status of other managers in terms of being under contract, he's a really easy option, and he probably is a short-term option for Real Madrid to keep the players in place.
Isn't the Real Madrid job by its very nature a short-term gig anyway? Yeah, so he's 68 now. Yeah. He could do a year or two there. And again, I don't want to downplay Zinedine Zidane's tactical acumen. He's clearly a very talented coach, right? And I've said that. The way he set them up in the big games, I mean, my goodness, he won three successive Champions League titles, for goodness sake. So he clearly has done something right. But more than that, it was the way that he managed that squad. He built a system that suited his players. And Arsene Wenger, I see as someone very similar, whereby he's going to gain the respect of the players. He's never really had an issue with egos. If you go throughout his career, he's always managed to keep the big players on side. You can question his preparation for big games, you can question his tactics, but if you think about it, the Thierry Henrys, the Patrick Vieiras, the big
Dennis
egos,
Bergkamp's.
Dennis Bergkamp's, he's always managed them very well. So in many respects, Arsene Wenger is a decent fit for Real Madrid.
Chris, I think whoever comes in there, I don't think it's going to be an easy job because I kind of feel that the team at the moment, there's a couple of question marks around age, the team performance. They're going to have to get a bit of new blood in there. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of when Fergie said cheers to Man United. It wasn't he didn't leave the team in the best of state, if I can put it as such. So whatever manager comes in there now, it's going to be a very, very difficult job. Benzema, do you keep him? Do you let him go? Ronaldo is really the wrong side of 30. Bale's been blowing a little bit of hot and cold, and you can kind of work your way through the team there. So I don't think it's going to be a very, very, very easy job. Can Arsene Wenger do the job? Of course he can do the job. I think, you know, he's a quality manager. And call it this transition area, it might be good to bring him in there for 2 years.
Here's the question, though. If you're a current Real Madrid player, if you're a guy like Ronaldo or Gareth Bale or Sergio Ramos, and you've been there a long time, Luka Modric, do you want to play for Arsene Wenger? I'm not sure that he is the guy they want to play to. And if they want to sign big-name players, they talk about Neymar for £300 million. If Arsene Wenger is your manager there, it's like, yeah, I don't know, he's yesterday's man. He's yesterday's man. He was great. When did he win something at Arsenal last? A decade ago. Give him a couple of FA Cups. A decade and a half ago.
Just dismissing FA Cups as if
2004, 2003, he was great with a great team. He hasn't won anything since then. He's done a great job managing egos. But if you're one of those global superstars, you're going, Arsene Wenger, yesterday's man. I want a modern, progressive coach. I want a guy that's the future. I don't want a guy that's the past. That would be the thing I would be thinking if I was a player there. I don't know what the answer is, but that's the question I'm posing. Is he the guy the players would want?
I think you're being a little naive, certainly in the case of Neymar, because at the end of the day, it goes far above Arsene Wenger. If it's a £300 million move that's been mooted, Neymar cares
Real
about
Madrid,
how much
though.
He's getting paid
but,
and playing in Spain for Real
but
Madrid.
Again,
he didn't join PSG for Unai Emery, did he?
No, but at Real Madrid, the thing about the manager, unlike what Wenger had at Arsenal, where he made all the decisions, he made the coaching decisions, he made the transfer decisions, he had to get the money. He has none of that control at Real Madrid because
only
we know
coaching.
The president runs the show at Real Madrid, and then the committee or the members or the club select the president.
Yeah, you're right. It's absolutely I think that will have to be the trade-off for Arsene Wenger, that you're right, he will not get total autonomy at that football club. He will be there to coach and to manage the egos on the training field and then ensuring that they get the results at the weekend, because everything else is looked after by other external forces, shall we say. Just gone 4:30, then we'll keep this conversation continue when we come back. Arsenal fans, Real Madrid fans, if you're listening this afternoon, get in touch with us on 4001. We'll get to some of your texts when we come back.
This is The Grill, in association with Barasti Superdome. Football lives at Barasti this summer.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. It is Chris McCarty, Carl Van Roosevelt and Mark Archer. We are with you through until 6 o'clock this evening. We are coming to you live from Barasti. That is the place to catch all your live action, not just today, but across the next 4, 5, 6 weeks, as well, of course, the FIFA World Cup. We've got Wimbledon as well. We've got Formula One. We've got cricket, international cricket matches and series to look forward to. The Rugby Union Internationals continue as well. So an awful lot going on in the world of sport. I've got a funny feeling, though, the numero uno on the big screens will be the FIFA World Cup. That is the one that is capturing an awful lot of imagination. We are building up to the women's final over at Roland Garros. It is Simona Halep taking on Sloane Stephens. That one getting underway in about 25 minutes' time. We will be building up to that one as we go over the course of the next half hour or so. But I just want to stick for football for a little while longer, boys, because I woke up to the news today that Kenny Dalglish, Liverpool, Scotland, Celtic legend, can't forget Celtic either, he has been knighted over in the UK in the Queen's Birthday Honours list. 67-year-old, he won 3 European Cups with Liverpool, managed them with great distinction as well, represented Scotland. You can make a very good argument to say Kenny Dalglish is Liverpool's greatest ever player. 67 years of age, he has been knighted, confirmed that he's going to be knighted, and he's had this to say in the wake of what must be one of the greatest honours you could possibly get.
A bit surprised and a wee bit embarrassed as well. Obviously, there's an awful lot of people done a lot of work. I don't really know what the process is or what they have to go through, but for everybody that made a contribution and maybe even had to tell one or two untruths about myself, to get it this far and to come out and be getting the accolade of what's been awarded is very humbling, but it's a great reflection on every part of your life, obviously with the charity as well, with Marina. that's been fantastically well received. If we've helped somebody, then I think that's what we're supposed to do. For Marina, it's fantastic credit to her, because she's been there for 40 odd years, and she set up a charity which has been hugely successful and rewarding for people less fortunate than myself, for all the kids. I'm sure they'll enjoy the stuff as well.
How integral has Liverpool Football Club been to you and the family?
I've said before that the football club has given me a lot more than I could ever have given them. So the people at Liverpool were fantastic to welcome us here, and for the whole family to be made to feel welcome and part of it and accepted. It's just very easy to settle down and be part and be successful, because the happier you are outside of life, outside of your work, the better chance you have of being successful. So for me, the reception we got when we came and the way that people have taken this to their hearts has been very, very helpful indeed. The football club is a magnificent institution anyway. Everybody's important, and the supporters have the role to play, the same as the office staff and directors, players, and there's nobody more important than anybody else, because if everybody works together, you've got a better chance of being successful, and that's all that we've ever tried to do.
And very finally, brilliant film out on you recently that sort of sums up how you are known, simply called Kenny. It's now going to be Sir Kenny. Has that sunk in?
Well, I still have to take the bins out. Alright, we'll still be the same as what we were before, and we'll continue to do what got us this far, and the way forward. It's a great honour for our family to have this, and it's a great honour for everybody that's made a contribution towards this day. So, it will not make any difference to myself, I don't think. I know it won't make any difference to myself, and it won't make any difference to the family.
Club allegiances aside, of course, regular listeners will know I'm no fan of Liverpool Football Club, but that Kenny Dalglish there, what a fine gentleman he is, humble in the extreme. And it's not just what he did on the football field as well. He's also been recognised for supporting the Hillsborough victims, his charity work as well with the Marina Dalglish appeal. That Marina, of course, is Kenny's wife. They've raised £10 million over the years, which is an incredible sum of money since that was set up in 2005. Kenny himself was made an MBE back in 1984, his wife Marina in 2009, and the relatives of the Hillsborough victims, they have long campaigned for the man they call King Kenny to be knighted. He's had his wish, or I say they've had his wish, of course, as he said there, he didn't ask for any of this, and as he made light as well in another interview, he said that when the letter dropped, he thought it was a tax bill coming in, and that knowing us Scots, if a tax bill lands on your mat, you run for the hills, so you do. So Kenny Dalglish, listen, it's a brilliant accolade, it is the highest honour you could be possibly given, and he is a deserving, and he will be, a Sir King Kenny.
Yeah, very classy individual, and by no means deserves exactly what he's got there with it being now known, knighted to become Sir Kenny. He's not the only sporting figurehead who's been honoured in the I think it's the Queen's birthday. One football player who we don't often associate with this type of stature is Defoe.
Jermaine
Defoe, who's actually also been given an MBE.
An OBE, it's an OBE, yeah, he's OBE been given
for his work with charity, with various charities and supporting sort of different foundations. So great to hear that he's been honoured. Also, your good friend, Chris.
Anthony Joshua.
I'm not sure what he's done to deserve an OBE, but they must be handing a few out, they must be short of the list this year. But he's won one so early in his career, really, so... Some athletes find them quite embarrassing to receive at times when there's a lot more people probably in the world who deserve these types of honours. But sportsmen do get honoured, and it's good to see sportsmen recognised in the honours list.
And in the case of Jermaine Defoe as well, not only again scoring goals, played 57 times for England in his career, he's done a lot from a charitable standpoint as well. And you look back and the relationship he had with a young fan, Bradley Lowry, who really did transcend the game of football. Of course, Bradley sadly dying at the age of 6 back in July 2017 after his battle with cancer, and Jermaine Defoe brilliant from him, and he's gone up in an awful lot of people's estimations as Jermaine Defoe. He actually tweeted out after it was confirmed he would receive an OBE in the Queen's birthday honours list. He says, "The proudest moment of my life is to be awarded an OBE. I'm blessed to have received the honour, but it isn't for me or about me. It's for Bradley and those he loved. I trade it all for him to be back in our lives. Forget the goals and awards. It's the memories I'll cherish." And he's also posted some pictures of him with young Bradley, who tragically lost his life at the age of 6. And Jermaine Defoe, for the work that he's doing, his foundation supports homeless, vulnerable and abused children over in St Lucia, where his grandparents were born, and has expanded now throughout the Caribbean and into the UK as well. So I guess never judge a book by its covers. Jermaine Defoe is doing an awful lot of great work, so congratulations to him. Anthony Joshua as well is doing a lot of charitable things as well, so congratulations to him. And of course, congratulations to Sir Kenny Dalglish. That puts you in the picture with some of the accolades and awards being handed out in the Queen's Birthday Honours list, and we wish all of those individuals all the very best indeed. We are 15 minutes out, though, from the start of the French Open final, the women's final, that is. It will see Simona Halep, who is, well, in her fourth Grand Slam final, she's yet to win one. She was beaten in the French in 2014 by Maria Sharapova. She was beaten in 2017 by the unseeded Yelena Ostapenko. She got to the final of the Australian Open earlier this year and was beaten by Caroline Wozniacki. Is this her time, Carl Van Roosevelt?
I really hope it is. And, you know, I think, like we were saying, that Lionel Messi deserves a World Cup. She deserves a Grand Slam title. You know, she's done everything in tennis. She's been world number one, and every time she's come so, so close. So I really hope it's her day today, Chris. She has been playing well, but I tell you what, it's not going to be easy against Sloane Stephens. Sloane made such light work of Madison Keys. We know what a good player Madison is, and Sloane has really been looking in very, very good form.
And we, of course, we know Serena Williams, now into the twilight of her career. She's a mother. Her attention, I don't want to say her attention's been taken away from the tennis court, but she's got other things to worry about now in her life. Sloane Stephens has been touted for a long time as being someone that could come up and really fly the flag for American women's tennis. She won the US Open, beating Madison Keys September of 2017, so last year. She's into the final this. You remarked on it, Carl. She's gone about her business, no frills. She's gone about it quiet, under the radar. She is there to spoil the party. I think we'd all accept that Simona Halep will start this today as favourite. But Sloane Stephens, given the fact as well she's won one, in many respects all the pressure is therefore on Simona Halep, and that can play into the hands of Sloane Stephens.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pressure on Simona Halep. And in last year's final, you know, we were just speaking about it, when she actually lost, and it seemed like that pressure just got to her. So I hope today is a different story for Simona. But as I said, Sloane Stephens, to me, has looked very, very solid throughout the tournament. She's moving very well. Her first serves have been fantastic. So I think it's going to be a tough, tough day for Simona Halep. But saying that, though, Simona Halep deserves to be a Grand Slam champion.
Yeah, she certainly does. 26 years of age is Simona Halep. Loved her comments in the build-up to this one. She said, "I've lost three times up until now. No one died," she points out. She's basically saying, you know, it's only a match. She's trying to alleviate the pressure. She says, "It's a big chance, but you never know. So I will just stay chilled." We are 50 minutes out from the start of the women's final. Updates throughout our final hour here on The Grill, 5 until 6pm. We will keep you up to date. And who knows, we've seen in the past blowout victories. Could there be another one today? If there is, we will tell you all about it. Just gone 10 to 5. When we come back, more chat, all things sport.
Unbelievable goal!
This is The Grill, in association with Barasti Superdome, bringing the football stadium to you this summer.
It certainly is. 10 to 5. We are building up to the women's final over at Roland Garros. Before we concentrate our efforts on that, let's put you in the picture of what's going on from a live perspective. We saw a little earlier, a busy day in the world of rugby union. New Zealand in action against the French. We've seen Ireland up against Australia, Japan, Italy. Carl Van Roosevelt, put us in the picture.
Yeah, what I can tell you is, Chris McCarty, it kicked off early this morning with Japan taking on Italy. The Japanese winning that one 34 points to 17. Then the All Blacks took on France and taught them a rugby lesson. The All Blacks running in 8 fantastic tries. They beating the French 52 points to 11. Australia have just seen off Ireland, beating them 18 points to 9. At 7 o'clock this evening, South Africa take on England. And then at 11:40, a little bit later on, Argentina will take on Wales.
What about the golf? There is action over in Europe and in the States. We'll start with you, Carl.
Yeah, what I can tell you is the St. Jude Classic, of course, is taking place over in the States. And former world number one, Dustin Johnson, what a fantastic 63 second round. He leads by one shot over Ryan Blom. followed there by Andrew Putman at 9 under par, CT Pan at 8 under par, and then Wesley Bryan at 9 under par.
The Short Clock Masters, the worst name in the European Tour. Short Clock Masters, tell us more on, first and foremost, I guess it makes sense. The name is in the title, Short Clock, right? So it's these players have got 30, 40 seconds to address the ball and get on with it.
It's all about trying to speed up the pace of play for the European Tour. So the hensely named Short Clock Masters is taking place just out of Vienna in beautiful Austria. And it's got to be fair to say, many of the big name players in the world have headed stateside because the US Open gets underway at Shinnecock Hills on Thursday, so they're either playing on the PGA Tour event this week or they're over there getting their practice and preparation together ahead of the second major of the year. So a lot of players we haven't heard too much of before are dominating in the Short Clock Masters, and of course you need to play your shots within a certain speed, otherwise you get penalised. So it's golf sped up, basically. Players are told not to take too long over putts. They've got, I think, 40 seconds over each shot, otherwise they get penalised. So at this stage, a lot of players having to play quickly, which is probably a good thing to keep the audiences attracted. The leader after seven holes of round three is the player from Iceland, Mikko Kahonen, is currently 11 under par, rounds of 68 and 67. He's 2 under today, so he's 11 under par, 2 shots ahead of Jean-Pepe Hadald from Norway, Adam Bland, Connor Schmeim, Miguel Angel Jimenez, Ashan Wu and Justin Walters. Names we don't usually, well, have struggling pronouncing on the European Tour. We are struggling this week, so it's the it's the man from Iceland leading the man from Norway at this stage.
Indeed, it is. Yeah, we'll keep an eye on the Short Clock Masters, and just, if anything, just to hear Mark Archer try and we'll pronounce those names once again. Better you than me, my friend. We are, what, 5 minutes or so away from the start of the French Open. Over the piece, have you caught much of the French Open over the course of the past fortnight, Carl?
Yeah, I've been watching when I can, and so far I've really enjoyed it. Of course, I was hoping for Novak Djokovic to go a little bit further. His comeback is complete, I guess. He's back in the mix, but still not doing enough to obviously get to the final. And of course, seeing Nadal in such fine form, you know, it just shows what a great clay court player he is. To me, I think the women's draw was a lot more competitive. I think that, as I said, Simona Halep obviously making the final. She's had a fantastic tournament, but there were a lot more close games. Of course, I was hoping Sharapova would go a little bit further, but yes, she did come undone there in the quarterfinals. But so far, fantastic display of tennis all round.
It certainly is. I guess the only disappointment from a woman's perspective is that Serena Williams was forced out of that tie against Maria Sharapova, because that was a story that was, again, capturing the imagination.
I was dying to watch that game, Chris McCarty. And of course, what Maria said about Serena in her book, you know, I was expecting a hotly contested affair. And as you say, for Serena to have to withdraw was a real dampen on the French Open.
Yeah, there was a bit of off-court tension between the two that may have been interesting to see when they would have gone head-to-head there. And I'm sure Venus, with a little bit of a bee in her bonnet about some of the things that were said. And
Serena.
And she would have actually made a point, but she had, a pectoral injury, which meant she actually couldn't serve. She struggled to serve and had to withdraw. And I think that may be playing on clay, playing at what Roland Garros in a slam where you've got to play a lot of long matches, a lot of matches within a two-week period. Her match fitness probably came through there, or lack of match fitness on playing, because she's been out for such a long time, and that was probably an issue with her physically. And then Sharapova sort of disappeared, which was a shame. But that was a hotly anticipated match. But I'm looking forward to the final. Two evenly matched players on paper. I think Halep, with a lot to prove, she's got that mantle now that Wozniacki's the player, the world number one without a Grand Slam. She'll be willing to put that to bed. It's probably as much psychological as physical for Halep. She needs to get off to a good start. If she loses the first set, it's going to be really interesting to see how she responds mentally. And you've got Sloane Stephens, who, you know, despite being number 10 in the world, has got a slam. So she's been there and she's done it. She knows how to win one. So it's a really interesting matchup. You think Halep, for me, goes into the final slight favourite.
I would agree with that, just for the fact that Sloane Stephens, up until this year, wasn't quite aware that she was such a proficient clay court player. But of course, the confidence that you get, and I think that's the key thing that we can never quantify. Sat here, three blokes down here at Barasti, having never played in a Grand Slam, and I've never seen either of you play tennis, but I don't imagine that you're good at it, to be perfectly honest.
Good enough to beat you, and probably good enough to beat Carl.
Carl, you need to take one, Arch.
No, he's probably not lying. I take him on a squash. I fancy my chances a bit more than. But hand and eye coordination, being an opening batsman, pretty good on a tennis court.
Yeah, decent. Okay. But on that front as well, just the fact that it is unquantifiable what winning a major, getting that kind of monkey off your back, as they say, what it does to you, because what you then do is you approach every Grand Slam with a new confidence, a confidence that it's probably very difficult for me to describe what that feels like, to walk in and know that I've been over the course before. I now know what it takes to win a slam.
But imagine the pressure on Simona Halep. Sloane Stephens has got nothing to lose today. She's got a Grand Slam trophy in her cabinet back home. To your point, Ms. Rodina, she hasn't had the best of years, but
she hasn't.
Exactly, and she's sitting in a final. But imagine being Simona Halep, where you're going, I've already lost 3 Grand Slam finals. I'm 9 to my 4th. I'm the world number one. There's so much pressure on me. A lot of people are asking questions. Will I become known as this world number one that's never won a slam? We know how long it took Wozniacki and everything that she went through and the major, major pressure on her until finally she got the monkey off her back. So going into the final today, yeah, I do agree with you guys. Halep might be the favorite, but I think she's got so much more pressure than what Sloane Stephens
Absolutely, she does. Just one other story from the French Open. We talked a little earlier just how just ominous Rafa Nadal, his form and just the way he's moving and the dismantling of Juan Martín Del Potro yesterday in that semi-final. But will be Rafa Nadal taking on the man many believe is his successor to dominate at the French Open. That is Dominic Thiem, the Austrian. But one of the other stories of the fortnight has been an Italian by the name of Marco Cicinato, the world number 72. He got to the semi-finals. He was beaten yesterday by Thiem in straight sets. It was a close affair, certainly for the first two sets. He lost it 7-5, 7-6, 12-10. In that second set tiebreak before then losing the third set 6-1. A bit of a walkout for Dominic Thiem. But the quarterfinal victory over Novak Djokovic, I watched this one, and full credit to Cicinato. The way he managed, yes, he lost his way a little in the third set, was blitzed 6-1, but the way he managed to get his emotions in check again, take out Novak Djokovic 7-6, 13-11 in that fourth set tiebreak. More than that, though, it's what Novak Djokovic has said afterwards. He has come out to say that he's now not sure whether he will play Wimbledon. The fact that Novak Djokovic, and again, I've got to be very careful, he's losing to what could be best described as a bit of a journeyman in the shape of Marco Cicinato. That's despite he's been, you know, the fact he's been excellent over this fortnight. What next for Novak? Something's clearly not right. We've said it time and time again. The elbow injury, okay, he may well have an elbow injury. There's a lot more going on behind the scenes that we're probably not privy to. The fact that he's coming out afterwards and saying, you know what, I'm not sure if I'm going to play Wimbledon, is that him just disappointed in the moment, or is there something that we can look at that long term?
I was actually speaking to somebody in Serbia the other day, and I was asking them about Novak Djokovic, and this guy's opinion is, he says, he's ultimately was one of the greatest tennis players of all time. He's a multi-millionaire. He's proved himself to the world. He's showed how good he is. What more does he need to prove? Does he really need to play? And if you kind of look at it, that seems to be his attitude at the moment, because I still believe he has it. I think the problem with Novak at the moment to me is he's not being patient. He's had a lot of injuries. There's a lot of good players coming through, but he wants to kind of start where he let off. And we know, Chris, when you come back from injury, you've been out the game for as long as he has, it's going to take time to get to where he was. So I just want him to be a little bit more patient, because clearly he's still got the game. Clearly he can still win slams, and he's a great, great tennis player.
He came out with some interesting comments, I think, this week, and he said, I don't think I can be as good as I was. For some reason, then mentally, he doesn't have the same mojo. His confidence has taken a bit of a battering, and we all know that when he was dominant, when he was the dominant player in tennis, he was probably better at his best than Rafa at his best, depending on what surface, and even Federer at his best. We know when Djokovic was at his very top of his game, he had a little bit over both those two. I think when he was the dominant sportsman, not just the dominant tennis player. When I think he lost 3 matches in the 1 year, maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
Five.
But he was as dominant a player in tennis as we have seen in the last couple of generations. As good as Federer has been, and his record's been unbelievable, the GOAT, undeniable. As good as Rafa has been, when Djokovic was on his very best A-plus game, I think he was still better than the two of them. And you can talk about surfaces, and we can sort of go through semantics, but he was that good. And now he's come to the decision after he's had the injury problems, he's had issues sort of off the court. He sort of said, I can't be that good again. And once you've made that up in your mind, you won't be that good again. It's as simple as that. So he's trying to set his expectations a bit lower about what he can do and how he can come back. But why would he not play Wimbledon? You think that's a surface that suits his way of play. He's won there before. If he's got his mental positioning right, if his head's okay, He should definitely be in Wimbledon, unless he's got some injury issues.
Benji, our producer, shaking his head at that comment that Novak Djokovic at his very best is better, or was better, than Rafa Nadal and Roger Federer at their very best. Of course, there's no right or wrong answer to this one. 4-0-0-1. Let us know your thoughts. Novak Djokovic, though, interested to see whether he will line up at Wimbledon. I've got a feeling he will. I think it was probably said in the heat of the moment. Just gone 5 o'clock. News headline time now. When we come back, we're into the final hour. We're building up to the Canadian Grand Prix qualifying. Fernando Alonso ahead of his 300th F1 race. I read an interesting comment this week as well, saying that only three legends of the sport have come out of F1 in the last 30 years, and he's one of them. I'll tell you the other two when we come back.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.